so best athlete of any president.
He's no, I mean athlete. He was. He won a
Same
national
we
championship.
Talk, we can talk about that.
Won a national championship.
I have a riff about that in my book.
Yeah, the center at the University of Michigan football team. He was part of the 1947 national championship team.
And there's no Soviet.
He got drafted by the NFL.
Sound like a dullard, but he wasn't a dullard. But you know, that's how history remembers him.
Yeah. Yeah. The accidental
embodiment of the mood of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is Chevy Chase.
Yeah, yeah.
Chevy Chase didn't go down too great in history.
Yeah, but you won't be remembered for that.
The first flash
picture.
The
first year. Yeah.
1975. Saturday Night Live debut. Crap, that's almost 40 years now.
How many of those people are dead?
Oh, SNL? There aren't many. That's like I think there's like three SNL alumni who died.
Comedy has a pretty high mortality rate.
That's true. Everyone's gonna die if you go in.
Well,
comedy.
I mean 100%.
In the long run, gentlemen, we are all dead. On a cheery note, shall we begin? Welcome to The Rise of Reagan. This panel presentation is a discussion with Rick Perlstein, author of the new book, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. Rick Perlstein is also the author of the highly acclaimed books Nixon Land and Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater, and The Unmaking of the American Consensus. There is a fuller biography, which I will read now, and then we will dive into a discussion. Rick Perlstein is the author of The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. Before that, he published Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, published in 2008. A New York Times bestseller, picked as one of the best nonfiction books of the year by over a dozen publications. He is also the author of Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus, winner of the 2001 Los Angeles Times Book Award for History. A contributing writer at The Nation magazine, former chief national correspondent for The Village Voice, and a former online columnist for The New Republic and Rolling Stone magazine, his journalism and essays have appeared in Newsweek, The New York Times, and many other publications. Politico called him the chronicler extraordinaire of American conservatism, who offers a hint of how interesting the political and intellectual dialogue might be if he could attract some mimics. The Nation called him the hyper-caffeinated Herodotus of the American century. Born in 1969 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, he lives in Chicago, and we are very lucky to have him join us. Please welcome Rick Perlstein.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's begin by talking about the title of the book. I feel like we should have a copy of it here, but I think you can talk about the book. So let me begin by actually asking about the title, The Invisible Bridge. What do you mean by that?
Well, it comes from a very interesting quotation spoken to Richard Nixon by, of all people, Nikita Khrushchev, when Nixon was in the Soviet Union in 1959 and gave his famous kitchen debate set up by William Sapphire. Khrushchev told him, gave him some advice, political advice, if the people think that there's an invisible river down there, don't tell them it's not there. Build an invisible bridge. In other words, bullshit. And in a sense, my book is about the history of political bullshit. And it starts in 1973 when several converging factors joined to kind of break the confidence of what had seen itself previously as God's chosen nation, the nation that had defeated Hitler, that had built the great American middle class, that had rose like a colossus and became the mighty economic powerhouse of the world. And those three factors were, of course, losing the Vietnam War, Watergate, in which people turned on their TVs in the summer of 1973 and saw White House official after White House official revealing themselves as little better than mafia associates, and the energy crisis, which most famously kind of hit its peak with the Arab oil embargo of October of 1973, but even started quite a bit earlier that spring when people were talking about the possibility of gas rationing over the Memorial Day weekend, and there was discussion of not only canceling auto races, but of extinguishing the eternal flame at the tomb of John F. Kennedy because it wasted energy. So America's really in trouble, but and we remember the 70s as a very kind of dark and lugubrious time. But I also try and recover a sense of real civic energy that was going on then. People were really beginning to think hard, even at the level of popular culture, about what it would mean to not see ourselves as the world's policemen, to begin to do things like conserving energy, not putting our leaders on pedestals. And I'm thinking of, for example, on the level of popular culture, a show like MASH, right? Most popular show, and if you think about it, it's a very subversive idea. It takes the traditional American narrative, the kind of John Wayne narrative, and just turns it on its head. The heroes are the insubordinate doctors who refuse to distinguish between the North Koreans and the South Koreans, think that the American military mission is wasteful and foolish. And the villain is the spit-and-shine officer, Frank Burns, who's the butt of every joke because he's always following orders and he's patriotic and dares to believe what the government is telling him. And what I narrate in this book, which covers the years 1973 to 1976, is a kind of a debate going on within the culture about this new vision of patriotism, about challenging our leaders, about throwing down the idols, and this more old-fashioned version of patriotism represented by Ronald Reagan, who challenges Gerald Ford in 1976 for the Republican presidential nomination and almost does something unprecedented, which is take the nomination away from a sitting president.
And so the focus of those years, it sounds like, is emblematic on the focus of this transition, where you had the kind of old school Republican guard, exemplified by Nixon, and now changed into the kind of the new standard that's exemplified by Reagan.
Right.
Fair
part
enough
of
to say?
It is the continued rise, which is kind of documented in a series of three books and soon to be four that I've written, of the rise of the right in the Republican Party and the takeover of the conservative movement. It's building up its own internal independent political infrastructure. Figures like Richard Viguerie, the conservative fundraiser, the beginnings of the Christian evangelical right. One of the most dramatic things I narrate in the book, the same school year as the Boston busing crisis, which is much more familiar. I talk about the textbook crisis in West Virginia, Kanawha County, West Virginia, in which the school board institutes what a bunch of fundamentalist preachers say are secular humanist, satanic textbooks because they ask students to read people like James Baldwin and have study questions like that compare the Greek myth Androcles and the lion and Daniel in the lion's den. In other words, putting Greek myth on the level of revealed Christian revelation. This movement becomes so intense that the anti-textbook activists end up dynamiting the school board, which would be a very interesting local conflict, but it becomes historic and a national issue because a brand new think tank, which has been established in Washington, sends down representatives to help these guys in their movement, in their legal defense. And that group is called the Heritage Foundation.
Now, that actually, you mentioned a phrase that kind of strikes, you really, really don't think about it, especially since you're talking about two Republican Party presidents, Nixon
right.
and Reagan. And yet you talk about the rise of the right.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's like, and then and in some ways it sounds kind of jarring, but then again, not necessarily so, especially given the fact that Richard Nixon, both Noam Chomsky and Michael Moore have described him and described Richard Nixon as our last liberal president. And it's kind of, as weird as that sounds, Given the policies that he did in office, it's understandable. Just a quick rundown of the list. The Environmental Protection Agency was founded. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, was founded. The Earned Income Tax Credit was established. The War on Cancer was established. The Fair Labor Standards Act saw a raise of 40% of American wages during the time when Nixon was president. So, yeah, as weird as, you know...
A corporate tax bill, which was the most regressive, an anti-regressive.
Yeah.
Well, but they're wrong still.
Okay, explain.
Presidents do not pick the policies and the laws that they sign from a catalog. They have to act in the political context that they're given. And the political context that Richard Nixon was given was a Democratic legislature that was basically dominated by liberals in a time in which the political center of gravity was far to the left than it is now. And, you know, I saw at the Nixon Library, a friend of mine went there a couple weeks ago and pointed out that one of the bills that they celebrate him for signing, because there's two things kind of the Nixon Foundation celebrates. One is they have people like Ann Coulter give speeches, and the other is that Nixon was this great liberal who, you know, like did wonderful things for blacks and women. But one of the bills that they were celebrating that he signed was an environmental bill that passed Congress something like by 425-10, right? So the fact of the matter is, if you want to know what Richard Nixon wanted to accomplish ideologically, you look at what he did after he won his 49th state landslide in 1972, which I write about in my book, Nixon Land. His budget for FY 1974, which Newsweek called the most important American political document since the New Deal, basically was recognizably what we would later call Reaganism. It sought to completely dismantle the great society and the war on poverty. He said in his memoir that basically his goal for his second term would be to fulfill the conservative mandate he'd been given in the election. Of course, that didn't happen. Richard Nixon didn't become Reagan because of the intervening troubles of that year involving Watergate. Ronald Reagan himself was responsible for some very liberal legislation that he signed, the most liberal abortion bill in the country. In 1967.
While he was governor of California?
Yes. Okay. And he said he was fooled into signing it, although, as you can see in my book, that's kind of questionable. He presided over several tax increases. But again, he was facing a very liberal legislature in California, and he wanted to get things done, and he wanted to be seen as a man of accomplishment. So, again, it's more complicated than that. The fact of the matter is, in the case of Richard Nixon, what he really bequeathed to the country that was lasting, and this is what my second book, Nixon Land, is about, is a certain kind of discourse of cultural resentment on behalf of the white middle class. The idea that these liberal snobs have it in for you, the kind of message we hear not only from, not too often these days, Sarah Palin, but, for example, a figure like Antonin Scalia, right, who last year there was a Supreme Court decision. And the question was it legal to execute, was cruel and unusual punishment to execute someone who was mentally retarded? And the facts of the case involved a person whose score on intelligence tests were, you know, 2 or 3 points above the threshold for mental retardation. But the expert witnesses pointed out that it was still within the margin of error, and so on, et cetera, et cetera. And basically, Antonin Scalia said, are you going to listen to the common sense of the American people, good, stout-hearted Americans like you and me, or these college professors? And that's the kind of discourse of reaction that Richard Nixon truly bequeathed to the nation, which was so important to the rise of conservative hegemony. Ronald Reagan made his own contributions, but that was Richard Nixon's signal contribution.
So if it turns out that that Nixon and Reagan were, I guess, victims of circumstance, as it were, but nonetheless, it sounds like that maybe ideologically they weren't all that far apart. Is that fair to say? Or are they, closer to the mark?
One of the most fascinating things I discovered in my research for this most recent book, The Invisible Bridge, was Ronald Reagan's reaction to Watergate. Alone among prominent politicians, he supported Richard Nixon to the end because he kind of divided the world into good people and bad people. And he simply classed Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew, too, by the way, as the good guys. So when he was asked on April 30th, when Richard Nixon gave a big speech saying, well, I've investigated Watergate, and it turns out it was all those people over there, and I've gotten rid of them, and so taking care of the problem. Ronald Reagan's response was that the Watergate conspirators weren't criminals at heart, and that was a shame that they had to go to jail. He said very similar things about Spiro Agnew. He said, in America, you're innocent until proven guilty. Of course, that same week, he also spoke of an accused cop killer and said he deserved to get the electric chair, even though he hadn't been convicted yet. So it's, again, good guys and bad guys. Somehow, Gerald Ford fell on the bad side of the ledger. So it's fascinating to see that even though when Richard Nixon was president, he supported the Nixon-Kissinger policy of détente, in other words, negotiating with the Soviet Union. As soon as Ford became president, he attacked it with a vengeance, and that was kind of a big part of why he...
this is Ford you're talking about? Ford attacked détente.
No. Reagan attacked détente once Ford was president.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about it was Ford was a pretty darn conservative figure, too. He basically made his mark as president by vetoing basically every bill. He vetoed 55 bills. And the idea was he was going to stop inflation by cutting this reckless spending that Congress was doing. But somehow he got tabbed as this kind of liberal interloper. And one of the stories I tell in the book is how Ronald Reagan's policy differences were not particularly different from Ronald Reagan, but their affect, their emotional tone was extremely different. And Ronald Reagan, when he ran for president in 1976, did a great job of kind of talking about the compromises that are required when you actually are the president and actually are governing as sellouts. So he did a great job of sort of speaking in opposition. And when he started running in all these primaries in 1976, he was doing quite poorly. Everyone was telling him he should drop out. And then he finally found an issue that just ignited his campaign. It's a very obscure issue now. Does anyone know what it is? It was the negotiations with Panama to renegotiate the Panama Canal Treaty, which conservatives considered a giveaway. They spoke about it like Henry Kissinger was giving away Omaha, or New Mexico. Ronald Reagan started giving speeches and saying, we built it, we paid for it, it's ours. Now, of course, if you actually look at the treaty that established the Panama Canal in 1904, it was just a classic example of gunboat diplomacy, colonialism. Basically, no Panamanians actually saw the treaty. Panama was part of Venezuela, and this French almost soldier of fortune who had the dream of building this canal found a bunch of basically swashbuckling Panamanians and said, we'll basically give you a government if you kind of do what we say and declare yourself the government of Panama. And backed by the force of a U.S. battleship, and the fact that the American company that controlled the rail lines from Venezuela to Panama shut down those rail lines, we basically stole the country of Panama. And that kind of worked out in 1904, but by 1976, or even by the 60s, when the Panamanian people began to riot in the canal zone, they would do things like raise the Panamanian canal, Panamanian flag. In an age of anti-colonialism, it just didn't fly anymore. And so basically, just kind of for several reasons that kind of made perfect technocratic sense, the fact that the newest ships couldn't even go through the canal, the fact that American battleships were too big to go through the canal, so it didn't really have any strategic purpose anyway. The fact that it was losing money, it made sense to turn it over to the Panamanians. But in the context of our defeat in Vietnam, and the context of, if you're a right-winger, the sense that America was surrendering its power, and the fact that school children learned of this glorious, heroic enterprise of building the Panama Canal, speak softly and carry a big stick, and Teddy Roosevelt and all that, it became an enormously compelling emotional issue. And when Reagan started giving these speeches, he started winning primaries because of that, and also because of this kind of almost underground conservative infrastructure that used things like direct mail and raising money using a loophole in the new campaign finance law that really didn't kind of show up. They started sort of like winning these primaries, and by the time they got to the 1976 Republican convention, it was a tie. And for the last time in our history, we had a presidential convention where the outcome was not known in advance. And that's the climax of the story. Who's going to pull it out? Jerry Ford or Ronald Reagan? No spoilers. But it was pretty darn interesting. Also, it's interesting because the people around Jesse Helms started challenging Reagan from the right, kind of like the modern-day kind of Tea Partiers. He wasn't even conservative enough for them.
So Reagan was able to use this like perfect wedge, not quite wedge issue, but the perfect issue that he could use to leverage to rally the troops and basically right-wing political activists,
right,
and folks.
As is so often the case with the history of the right in the 60s and 70s, they kind of lose the battle but kind of win the war,
yeah,
because they're strong enough to force this conservative platform on the party. And one of the things is, for example, they forced this morality in foreign policy plan, which is basically this outright rejection of Henry Kissinger and Nixon. And basically, Reagan gets to choose the running mate, who is Bob Dole, who's this acerbic Kansas conservative. And right now, researching my fourth volume, which is going to go from the 1976 general election through 1980, and it's so fascinating to see Ronald Reagan, who basically boycotts campaigning for Gerald Ford, but will campaign for the Republican platform, which he's basically written.
It's that, I guess, the sense of the, and going back to the issue regarding the rise of the right, the fact that, you know, it's that the philosophical ideals that might be described regarding the rubric of conservative, mm-hmm, that it seemed like where before they had been the kind of in the defeatist muster, and now
right,
the flag for victory. And,
yeah,
and certainly the motivation for Reagan certainly wins in 1980, not only the Republican
right
nomination.
And
the
of course, this is all the, these are all the people who come out of the 1964 Barry Goldwater campaign,
right,
which, you know, loses 45 states and only wins, you know, like 40% of the vote. But they've basically taken over the precinct structure, the ward structure. Chicagoans all know about that, of the Republican Party. And the only person who really appreciates that after 1964, when everyone, all the pundits are saying that the Republicans have to purge the conservatives if they ever want to survive as a party again, is Richard Nixon. So he knows that he has to kind of campaign in the South. He has to kind of please this Republican base in order to get the nomination in 1968.
In the course of this kind of evolution, I guess part of me thinks if it could be kind of also writing the kind of the nerdy technical term is neoliberalism. The idea that where in the 1960s, maybe early 1970s, are kind of emblematic of the kinds of concerns for the public that are exemplified by what a lot of people think of as that time. There has been, arguably from the mid-1970s, certainly up through maybe even considerably to today, the idea about you know, markets being above all, limiting the power of labor unions, maybe even abolishing them outright, and privatizing everything. That whole nexus of idea of what's been referred to as neoliberalism, it seems like, is also kind of gaining ascendancy as well. And it might seem to me, and I'm open to correction on this, that Reagan was probably not only riding its coattails, but also helping to fan its flames.
That's exactly
Is that
right.
fair to say?
He was not, yeah, you know, basically, Reaganism was riding a wave that he was not solely responsible for creating. In fact, researching the 1980 presidential nomination fight for the Republicans, it's fascinating. Basically, all the candidates, George Bush, all these forgotten people like John Connolly and Phil Crane, and basically all of them, except for this one guy, John Anderson, who ends up running as an independent. We're all basically running as conservatives. And all the Reaganites, all the new right people, were kind of divided between these various campaigns because, first of all, Reagan was seen as too old to run anyway. The last line of the Invisible Bridge, not to give it away, is the New York Times saying, well, that was very interesting, but he's obviously too old to run for president again in 1976. I love
making
fun of the pundits. And he's
65 at the time, I think?
He was 65, right.
Yeah.
The other thing is, it's very easy to kind of identify liberalism as a failed project in the middle and late 1970s. If you're running for any kind of national political office in the 40s and 50s and 60s as a liberal, as a Democrat, basically you are running as Santa Claus. Basically, you're saying we're going to increase government spending and put money into your pocket. You know, and the Republicans had this anguish cri de coeur. Nobody shoots Santa Claus, right? And this is Keynesianism. This is the idea that the job of the government is to spend money and put money into ordinary people's pockets, and that's how you drive the economy. Unfortunately, what happens in the middle of the 1970s when we get this absolute awful clogging of America's economic arteries, you have something unprecedented. You have both high unemployment and high inflation, which are supposed to be incompatible with each other, because if there's high inflation, you're supposed to slow down the economy, and if there's high unemployment, you're supposed to speed up the economy. But there's both. What are you supposed to do? Economists mm-hmm. have no idea. They literally, the reason that there's they start instituting the Nobel Prize for economics in the 1960s was basically enshrining economics as a science, because economists were these heroes who had figured out a way to end the age-old scourge of boom and bust. But by 1970s, this is not happening. And so suddenly the basic appeal that the Democrats have to ordinary working-class voters doesn't seem to work anymore. And at the same time, you get this period of profound cultural confusion. These Christian fundamentalists in West Virginia, what were they reacting against? Well, the person who was the leader of their movement, she started out as a crusader against sex education, right? All these kind of 60s social movements were beginning to kind of work their way into sort of the institutions of society. And it caused this, you know, kind of great confusion and consternation, such that the very politically quiescent fundamentalist churches suddenly began getting involved in politics in 1973, 1974, 1975. And then they really go in whole hog in 1978, 1979, when Jimmy Carter's IRS commissioner rules that these church schools that were founded in the wake of desegregation couldn't get IRS deductions as tax-deductible organizations if they didn't have any African-American students. And this is really the catalyst that builds things like the Moral Majority, that sends Jerry Falwell into politics. Now, they lie about it. They say that it was Roe versus Wade, but Roe versus Wade was almost exclusively a Catholic issue in the early 1970s, 1973, 1974, 1975, 1976. People started talking about it as a potential issue in 1976, but basically Carter and Ford have the same kind of wishy-washy position about it. But by 1980, you get this full-on kind of Republican culture war, and it's completely changing the face of American politics. The day after the night when they finally call the election for Reagan in 1980, I had this DVD of the interviews on ABC News, and three towering giants of the Senate, George McGovern, Frank Church, and Birch Bayh, all great liberals, have all lost. Birch Bayh loses to this kid named Dan Quayle. Frank Church loses because he voted for the Panama Canal Treaty and gave away the Panama Canal and also investigated the CIA. George McGovern's George McGovern. And they're interviewed and they're like shell-shocked. They can't even believe it because they've been raised to believe that America was a liberal country. And suddenly this blind side, this actor in his coattails, have swept them out of a job. And they're interviewed and they're like, you can see the sort of confusion and sadness in their eyes. And then Jerry Falwell. And he's taking credit for the election. And he looks like the cat who ate the canary. It's like, we won. We've taken back America.
And then that kind of also, that gloms together the kind of three, maybe parallel, but maybe unified to some extent, but really unified in the wake of the Reagan Revolution. The various strands that comprise right-wing political movements in the United States, that is the religious right.
The
economic free market or corporate types, and people who have kind of a bugaboo about race.
Well, here's the interesting thing about the economic stuff. So there's this whole idea, right, no one shoots Santa Claus, that the Democrats have this wonderful thing that they're selling, which is like, we're going to bring you into the middle class and keep you in the middle class. And then the Republicans have is, you know, Jerry Ford vetoing stuff, you know, vetoing, mm-hmm. you know, increases in Social Security, vetoing, you know, all sorts of programs that are going to sort of equalize wealth. And all the Republicans seem to do is say no. And one of the kind of deus ex machinas that allows Reagan to triumph in 1980 is this new economic doctrine. The political backer of it is Congressman Jack Kemp, former football star from Buffalo, and a bunch of basically editorialists for the Wall Street Journal and heterodox economists who say, you know, if we just lower everybody's taxes, the economy will explode with dynamism. And it'll not only it will lower unemployment without inflation, it will increase the revenue to the federal government. What they're proposing is this kind of miracle of the loaves and the fishes, which really was kind of like what Keynesianism in its heyday did. So in order for Republicans to really kind of come out on top of the economic argument, first of all, the Democratic argument no longer seems to work. And they're offering something, well, it ends up not to work either, but it sounds fantastic. It's no longer, we're going to, you know, keep you from eating your dessert. It's, we're going to give you dessert. And that, along with, yes, the sort of backlash against the kind of the 1960s and the religious right, proves to be a very powerful coalition.
One which I think is kind of held sway until, like, maybe in recent years, where you're seeing a kind of division,
ages. They did pretty well in November.
But to be fair, that's in an off-year election, and they're, you know, that's only 2 years that they would have before 2016.
Well, we're basically in a political situation where, because of gerrymandering and the anti-democratic nature of the Senate, I think the Republicans, you know, keep the legislature for as far as the eye can see. But when you have the larger electorate in a presidential year and sort of what they call the new electorate, the sort of young people and Hispanics, largely,
mm-hmm.
Democrats win the presidency. So what you see is this kind of 2 year changing the guard.
Yeah.
We go, you know, 2000 Bush, 2002, the Democrats did good. Actually, you can go back further.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats did great in 1998 in this reaction against the impeachment. Bush kind of wins in 2000. Democrats come back in 2002. Republicans win in 2004. Democrats come back on the Iraq War in 2006. So it's kind of you have this stalemate. But every time the Democrats lose, I mean, every time the Republicans lose, you also have a structural feature of our politics, which goes back to 1964, which is that the pundits, the people whose job it is to explain what's happening, declare the conservative movement dead. And they're serially humiliated, because my argument in all my books is that, at least going back to the Civil War, if not the Constitutional Convention, that this coalition of reaction is really a constitutive part of our political DNA. The fact is that the people who are heir to the Enlightenment, you know, kind of the journalist class, never really see it as a real thing. You know, they always see it as an epiphenomenon. So at the end of my first book on Barry Goldwater, it ends with all these pundits saying the Republican Party, or even the two-party system, may not live to see another day unless conservatives are purged. And, you know, in 1974, after Watergate, I found all kinds of examples of not only pundits, but books saying that the Republican Party, which is, by the way, only has 18% party identification, is dead. And I even have in the Invisible Bridge, I quote a pundit, very prominent pundit, kind of Tom Friedman of the day, saying that Reaganism has had it in California. And he gives us the example, the primary election, California, 1974, because Jerry Brown wins and Reagan's handpicked candidate loses for governor. And they're so eager to kind of declare Republicanism and conservatism dead. And you saw the same thing 3 or 4 months ago. Said, oh, well, there's this battle between the Republican establishment. They're taking back the Republican Party from the Tea Party. And, like, you know, 2 weeks later, you know, Eric Cantor loses his seat to the Tea Party.
But nonetheless, you might think that, or at least I hear the argument posed that the Republicans might, again, the prediction that, you know, they're doomed now. But
this time they're really doomed.
Might they be really doomed now because of the demographics of it all?
No, because let me give you the example they made in the argument they made in the late 1950s. People were like, the demographics are dooming the Republican Party because the Republican Party is a party of WASPs. And look at the trends. There aren't as many WASPs. You know, the rising electorate. They talked about the rising electorate. Now the rising electorate now was what they called white ethnics, Italian. Poles, Irish, or Democrats. Well, those same people are now the foundation of the Republican Party. The fact of the matter is, just because young Hispanics are natural Democrats now, political preferences are not inscribed in our DNA. You know, as Hispanics move into the middle class, the question is, are they going to be like Jews, or are they going to be like Italians? You know, are they going to stay Democratic, or are they going to become do the same thing that every bourgeoisie does before it, which is kind of pull the ladder up on which they climbed and preserve their privilege? And I think that's an open question. And now that you know, Obama, at least for the time being, has removed the immigration question from here's the thing. So in 2016. Obama did something very smart in that there's going to be millions of Americans, millions of immigrants who are citizens, obviously, and who can vote, for whom who becomes president in 2016 is going to be a matter of sort of life and death for their families who don't have papers, right? So they're going to be extremely motivated to vote. But if we do get comprehensive immigration reform written into the books of law in a non-temporary way, well, that removes immigration as an issue. And the Democrats will no longer, they can campaign on, well, we're the guys who gave you this, right? But the Democrats campaigned on, we're the ones who gave you Social Security and Medicare. But once, you know, these white ethnics had, you know, moved out to, you know, Berwyn and Elmhurst, you know, in DuPage County, and were worried about, you know, keeping their lily white suburbs lily white, and preserving their kids' schools, they were perfectly happy to forget about that Republican. So demographics is not destiny. It's a very important part of the journalism I did when I was writing for The Nation in 2010 and 2011.
Let's talk a little bit about the book itself. So it's one thing that's been noted about it, especially seeing a copy of it here, more than 800 pages long.
Yeah.
So quite a lot.
Because it's lots of fun stuff to write about.
When did you begin writing it?
Anthony Trollope, you know, British novelist, start his next novel on the last page of the previous one. So I kind of like, you know, just kind of finished Nixon Land.
It's like
in
volume six now.
2007. No, volume four is going to be the last one, and then I'm going to like cultivate my bonsai trees. only so much you can write about Republicans and maintain your sanity. Yeah, I pretty much started right when I finished Nixon Land. Although when I started the series, it was the late 90s. Now I was definitely conceiving a series that went to 1980. So. Or you can even go back when I was 16 and tooling around at the Renaissance bookstore in Milwaukee and picking up books on, you know, the Black Panthers and the John Birch Society and stuff.
When you started the book series that's now comprised three volumes, when you started that, did you have in mind, I'm going to write a series of four books?
Three books? This one became, you know, it's a bit of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. It was supposed to go to 1980. But it was just one of the reasons that I kind of ran out of pages before I kind of ran out of time before I ran out of pages, or whatever it is no historian had ever written about what it was like for the public to experience Watergate. People have written all kinds of great behind-the-scenes stuff, what it was like in the Oval Office, what it was like in Congress, Woodward and Bernstein, but no one wrote about what it was like to turn on the TV and see your country going to shit. And that's the experience I wanted to convey in The Invisible Bridge. That's a good, you know, 200 pages of the book, is, you know, those hearings. You know, Sam Ervin, Barbara Jordan, the letters to the editor, the fact that this kind of Fox News attitude, this was all a bunch of sour liberals who are trying to reverse the mandate of 1972, and isn't Chappaquiddick and Ted Kennedy worse? No one talked about that on the Sunday shows, but it was all over in the letters to the editor, right? So that kind of right-wing reaction was present. It was, in a lot of ways, just as prevalent in the country as it is now, but it just hadn't worked its way into the mainstream of political expression. So I tried to capture all that. I have a friend whose brother told me that he was absolutely thrilled to have had a debilitating back injury in the spring of 1973 because he's got to spend the whole summer in traction on his back and got to watch the Watergate hearings every day. And it was just astonishing. You know, it's like this guy, John Dean, right, this White House aide, now I'm proud to say a friend of mine, testifies all day, is questioned for four straight days after that everything that Richard Nixon has said up to that point about Watergate was a stone lie. And here it is, the word of this junior aide whose job it was in the White House to cover up Watergate, his word against the President of the United States. And he was absolutely savaged in the press. The White House managed to leak that the reason he was spilling the beans was he was afraid to be raped in prison. Really, this is you'd see this in like, you know, like this punk, John Dean, and guys like, you know, Joseph Alsop were writing columns about what an awful human being he was and how he was making all this up. 75% of the population watched John Dean on TV testify. I mean, it was just like way more than watched the Super Bowl. And that's why I'm kind of nostalgic for this. There's this incredible level of civic engagement. You were there. You remember. Everyone was absolutely obsessed. And what are you going to do? The president says he said one thing. This junior aide says the other. Well, lo and behold, a couple weeks later, what happened? That's right. This guy, this even more junior aide, Alexander Butterfield, says, oh, by the way, the president taped everything. What? So tell me if we find a divergence of opinion of of testimony between what the president says he said and what Don James, you would get the tape. And then suddenly there's a whole year of legal wrangling about whether Richard Nixon is going to give up these tapes, which he says are his sole property. And then people are suddenly talking about, well, will he hold on to the tapes through force of arms? Is he going to deploy the military? Are we going to have the United States anymore? Are we going to descend to a fascist, you know, autocracy? There's a special prosecutor who, by the way, is a Kennedy man and a liberal and a Harvard professor, everything that Richard Nixon hated. And he starts subpoenaing tapes. And what does Richard Nixon do in October of 1973? He fires him. How does he fire him? He has the FBI seal his office with guns. And people start talking about a fascist coup in the United States. Richard Nixon pulls back from the brink, but the next spring and summer, as the House Judiciary Committee has televised hearings, Barbara Jordan gives this grand speech. My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. This African-American woman from the South. After the first day of testimony, in which all these members of the House Judiciary Committee give their 15-minute speeches, Barbara Jordan is one of them, the chairman, Peter Regina, orders the hearing room cleared. Why? Does anyone know? Has anyone read the book? Because there's a rumor that someone's going to smash a plane into the Capitol building. And it sounds credible. That Richard Nixon might stop at nothing. So that's why it's an 800-page book. There's so much melodrama. And that's only, you know, kind of one of, you know, like the first, you know, two-fifths of the narrative.
Yeah. And Frank Rich in the New York Times in the review of the book, Rosetta Stone for Reading America, and especially its politics today.
Others disagree.
in 30 seconds, please explain.
Well, there's kind of two broad currents of criticism. The one comes from the right, which is that in the book I argue basically that Ronald Reagan fundamentally divides the American people into people who think he's a hero given to us by Providence and people who think he's a giant phony. And the people who think that he's a hero given to us by Providence, who have their own magazines, prove my point by saying that Rick Perlstein doesn't understand that he's a hero given to us by Providence. So that's one. It's just the one. There's a kind of like a right wing version of the New York Review of Books called the Claremont Review of Books. I just got the review in the mail. It was written by a guy who's a professor at the university, at Pepperdine University. He's the Ronald Reagan Chair of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. I mean, I thought that was a pretty
Wasn't
funny
that Ben
Stein's
job,
of
I thought.
I was aware of the review, but I wasn't aware that the it's illustrated with a caricature of me leaning back on a cowboy boot marked Ronald Reagan amidst a display of books. It says dazzling, you know, all these kind of like liberal book reviewers, and I have my hands against my head and I'm looking all smug, right? And one of the things the review says is lots of people have tried to liberals have tried to debunk Ronald Reagan's greatness using issues like economic inequality and civil rights and other fashionable campus concerns. So that's one. The other fascinating stream of criticism has kind of come from centrists and kind of the pundit class that I kind of so kind of roundly deride. It's they always live to see another day, no matter how many bad predictions they make. Mm-hmm. And one of the fascinating things about these guys is people like Sam Tannenhaus. He used to be the editor of the New York Times Book Review. He wrote a long review in the Atlantic Monthly in which he called me a web aggregator and said some people will think he's lazy. And one of the reasons for that is because I try to, wherever possible, sort of recreate the feel of the era by using the public cult, the popular culture, and the newspapers and the magazines that people read to kind of give this kind of collage effect. But lots of reviewers like that, also the former editor of Slate, who was Robert Rubin's ghostwriter and things like that, he also despised it. I think the reason these centrists have a problem with the book is they really need the idea of a responsible, respectable right to kind of make the argument that it's really extremists on both sides that are causing problems country, the problems of the country. And one of the things I do in my work is demonstrate, I hope, that Reaganism bears within it some constitutive flaws that make it hard to kind of respect. And so I kind of eat away at their kind of core conception of themselves and their public role. So they've been savage. But other people seem to like what I'm doing. And I got a contract to do the next one, so I'm happy.
When's the next one due?
About 2.5 years.
Okay.
It's going to be shorter and it's going to be quicker. And I think it's going to be... style's going to be a little bit different.
Do you have a title yet?
No, I don't. Any ideas?
No? Why don't we open it up? Any ideas for titles or other questions for folks? You can get paid for to do that?
He gets paid.
Well, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's why I get the big bucks. Yeah.
But I would ask you a question. Just a leading question. Your background to get into this kind of thing. Political science or history or anything like that?
Well, I was a history major at the University of Chicago. But I mentioned the Renaissance bookstore in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
I mean, I just loved when I was a teenager and got my driver's license to just root around and read old magazines.
Yeah.
Read old books, and I was always obsessed with the 60s. That's really where it comes from. Growing up in the 80s, you know, super boring, you know, and it was all just kind of Cosby sweaters and you know, Reagan, and just the 60s just seemed like fantastically romantic and interesting. I mean, it's the idea that, like, I grasped right away that, like, you know, 1985 and 1989 weren't really that different, but 1964 and 1968 were like night and day. Right, mm-hmm. And just like the pace of that change is absolutely fascinating me, and I think I picked up pretty early that the story that was told about the 60s by kind of 60s veterans was kind of a one-sided story, and it was you know, kind of a story of, you know, kind of idealistic kids who became increasingly radical, and that really what we're looking at in the 60s was a civil war between. And as I spent 2 years in graduate school, but really kind of wanted to write for a broader public, and became a magazine editor in New York for a magazine called Lingua Franca, which covered academia and ideas. And I did a cover article called Who Owns the 60s? The Opening of a Scholarly Generation Gap. And it was about how younger scholars who were writing histories of the 60s were coming up with completely different pictures of the 60s. And one of them was to bring the story of the right and Reaganism to the forefront. And that's when I kind of got the idea of doing the first book.
The meaning was to, economic conditions aside, so mm-hmm. I hope they're not anywhere near what they were in 1980, in 2016, but could there be a reprise of the 1980s type Republican side presidential nominations in 2016?
That ship has sailed, my friend. I mean, the conservatives have completely taken over the Republican
Except
Party.
Except that there's nobody.
Oh,
as
oh,
opposed to Reagan in 76
right,
getting
right.
Himself, you know,
well, I mean, Reagan. That's where the kind of these kind of fascinating, you know, it's like the old problem sketched by Tolstoy about, you know, is history forces or is it, you know, individuals? And Reagan really is this extraordinary figure who was able to. You know, take what can be a very just kind of fundamentally sort of dark and unpleasant view of the world as given to us by Richard Nixon and give it this, you know, sunshiny face. So he's an extraordinary individual, and that's why he's so important to the conservative movement, because they've been trying to bottle that for so long. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically both Scott Walker and Cruz, you know, were kind of bred in this kind of conservative movement test tube. You know, Cruz comes out of this kind of evangelical debating society world and was the Solicitor General of Texas, and he basically was a Solicitor General for all the red states and was just kind of the kind of go-to guy for conservative legal arguments before he became a senator. And Scott Walker kind of comes out of this kind of libertarian world, but you know, neither of them have that kind of mass appeal that Reagan had. But they've done such a great job at sort of manipulating the levers of power. You know, one of the things that Newt Gingrich did to kind of vouchsafe the hegemony of corporate forces in Congress was he cut back the congressional staffs and cut back things like the Congressional Research Office, and that made the role of lobbyists much more important. The gerrymandering, the Supreme Court decisions on speech. You know, you might not have a Reagan, but you have a whole generation of young law students who basically see the New Deal and the role of the 10th Amendment as allowing things like social legislation and minimum wage legislation as illegitimate. And so I like to say, you know, right now we have the most conservative Supreme Court justice is an African-American married to a blonde woman, which was a lynching defense, a lynching offense in most of our lifetimes. I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, like a Republican appointed or maybe even Democratic appointed Supreme Court justice married to someone of the same sex voting to, you know, eliminate the federal minimum wage. So get out there and vote.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
How much do you think by the time Reagan was president, he had become maybe just a figurehead president who was maybe controlled by the Bush administration? I don't know.
Well, there's always the question of, you know, was Reagan a puppet for kind of forces outside? And, you know, that was always the rap on him. And there's some pretty extraordinary things about him. He could be very spacey. He did fall asleep during cabinet meetings. And, of course, during the second half of his presidency, he probably was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. But at the same time, there are all these examples of people trying to control him and programming him. I mean, him outsmarting them every time. Let me give you a really good example. When he ran for governor, he had the best consultants. They had the best polling, state-of-the-art kind of campaign management for the time. And this is 1966. He's running for the gubernatorial nomination. And they're like, they realize the problem is people think he's a stupid actor. So they come up with this idea, never realized, probably, thank God, that he was going to be announced his candidacy for governor with two Berkeley Nobel laureates standing by his side to prove that he wasn't dumb.
Well, that'll do it.
They didn't do that, but he kept on, this was the, you know, the years of the Berkeley free speech movement, and he kept on giving speeches wrapping what he called the mess at Berkeley. You could say, I'd like to harness their youthful energy like with a strap. Or a hippie is someone who looks like Cheetah, dresses like Tarzan, and dresses like Jane, looks like Tarzan, and smells like Cheetah. You know, all this stuff. And his all these incredibly sophisticated advisors says, look, Mr. Reagan, stop talking about Berkeley. It doesn't show up in any of our polls as a concern. And he just basically looked them in the eye and said, you know, I don't care what your polls say. Every time I bring it up, I'm doing a listening tour, and anytime someone just asks a question about Berkeley, it gets a standing ovation. So he had this emotional intelligence that all great politicians have. And what that emotional intelligence consists of, and Obama had it too, is to be able to kind of read the rooms they're in and detect sort of the underlying, almost unconscious concerns of the electorate before it even emerges and is articulated as something that you can call an issue. So, of course, Berkeley didn't show up in their polls because no one knew that misbehaving college students were something that you could vote about. You know? He turned that into an issue. And so, yeah, they tried to manipulate him, but they failed. And had they been able to manipulate him, tell him what to do, he probably wouldn't have won the nomination in the governor's race because that was the issue that really established him, not only in the state of California, but nationally. One of the things that was so brilliant about it was Reagan was always able, for reasons I explain in a little more detail in the book, was able to reach out to these blue collar white union voters. And one of the reasons the Berkeley issue and kind of these misbehaving college students was so profound in his ability to do so was because these guys weren't able to go to college. And the fact that these privileged brats were, you know, in this interpretation, spitting on their privilege, burning down their schools, was an incredibly compelling message. And still is in many ways. Fashionable campus concerns.
I'm just curious about source material in this digital era, obviously there's so much that's available and a lot of the major players are dead, right? So
thank God. The dead cannot sue for libel.
Is there a lot of folks you were able to interview and other people who were particularly informative and helpful?
You know, I did a lot of interviews in my first book on Barry Goldwater because a lot of these guys, because Barry Goldwater lost, especially the ones who didn't kind of stick with the winners, Nixon and Reagan, were obscure figures. Once people kind of like, you know, it's like I don't think I would have got much from, you know, interviewing, say, Caspar Weinberger. Because once these guys get into power, they pretty much say what they want to say. And they write memoirs, and they're very circumspect. And there's this kind of not much utility kind of chasing these guys down and trying to get interesting new stuff. Now, in the case of Invisible Bridge, I was very careful to really focus on material that was kind of what an ordinary, well-informed, or even kind of poorly informed citizen would have at their disposal. Because it's really a history of shifts in kind of public consciousness and public sentiment. It's not backroom stuff. There's some of that, but very little. So I'm much more interested in what was on the news than, you know, what was happening, you know, in, you know, the Dirksen Federal Office Building.
Are there particular archives that are pretty
Well, Google Historical Newspapers is fantastic. You can basically flip through pages, you know, if you want to look at all the, you know, sort of, the, you know, if you want to look at the Lodi News Sentinel, you know, for January 27th, 1975, just go to page one and look at all the ads and all the articles, page two, page three, and all the rest. What's really fun is, I would love to spend more time there, the Vanderbilt News Archives has every evening newscast since 1968, and it's fully indexed. So you can basically kind of go on their search page, you can do that online, and you have to actually go to this magic time machine in Nashville to do it, although it's because the networks are so proprietary about the newscasts, they somehow think they're going to someday become a profit center. The guy there said, yeah, we could just write a few lines of computer code and turn this into a big YouTube site, this enormous public resource, which is actually what they have in France. So, like, let's say your Uncle Fred, you know, like, had set the world record for pole sitting in 1981, you could go down to Nashville and watch him on the news. And that's just an amazing resource because that's how people get their news. That's how people form their consciousness, you know, through TV. And you learn a lot from watching those old newscasts because part of the story I'm going to be telling about America in this fourth volume is the increasing trivialization of the culture. And one of the things that happened was the newscasts, as we some of you guys know, were not meant to make money. They were meant to be money-losing propositions to increase the prestige of the networks, partly so they could keep their broadcast licenses. But one of the things Reagan did when he was in power was he loosened those restrictions. And the first things the networks did was, you know, they started turning the newscasts into, you know, much more fluffy things. If you watch a newscast in 1974 or 1976, and you spend a half an hour watching, you know, like Walter Cronkite, you pretty much know what you need to know to be a well-informed citizen. And it's real eat-your-spin stuff. They don't smile. There's no fluff. It's just, here's what's happening to the dollar. You know, here's what's happening in Cyprus. You know, here's what's happening in the House Judiciary Committee. And that's gone. That's gone.
Yes, sir.
Are you arguing that the post-Watergate questioning of authority and the subversive popular culture then was a short-lived period?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And that things turned to more escapism, like the disco.
Yeah, things like, I read a lot in this book about, so it ends in the summer of 1976 with that Republican convention, but I also write a lot about the bicentennial. And one of the fascinating things about the bicentennial was a lot of the discourse about it beforehand was basically America doesn't deserve to have a birthday party or can't have a birthday party or things are so crappy, so we can't enjoy a birthday party. And by the way, there were 87 terrorist bombings in America in 1975. You had Puerto Rican separatists, you had Marikahani, you had New Left Radicals, you had the Simeonese Liberation Army, you had the Red Army family. And a lot of people thought that basically this would be, you know, like there was a a bomb in the luggage terminal, the luggage, you know, the luggage area of LaGuardia. Yeah, like in December of 1975, in the Christmas season, they killed 30 people. People were like, well, if we have all these public celebrations, aren't there just going to be terrorist attacks? And then the day itself and the celebrations and the discourse in retrospect is kind of like, wow, you know, it's not so hard to kind of have this kind of knee-jerk kind of jingoistic flag waving after all, which I found fascinating. And it was a real kind of watershed. You know, it was like, there was a certain infantilization going on. Whereas, if you think about kind of the golden age of Hollywood in the 70s, this is real mature adult stuff. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest made $100 million. You know, Rocky the next year, that's the Academy Award-winning picture. Rocky, this kind of very slight, you know, kind of escapist picture, wins the Academy Award the next year, makes like $300 million. And a friend of mine who was in Hollywood said, well, the reason everyone voted for Rocky was because everyone's sick of all these sad pictures. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, this was uplifting. You know, you can really see the Reaganite screen in that kind of thing. And you get, like, TV executives like Fred Silverman, you know, who, you know, is responsible for, you know, The Love Boat. You know, Rune Arledge, you know, who was the head of ABC Wide World of Sports, and he becomes the head of news for ABC. And gives us, you know, basically turns the Iran hostage crisis into a soap opera. And on that happy note. Any last questions?
In the back.
You said demographics is not fate, so to speak.
Yeah.
But isn't there a different a motivation going on now which started, it seemed to me, with Reagan, with the welfare queen and the racialization and now you've got the demonization of immigrants of the Hispanic.
I'm not saying it's smart for the Republicans to do that.
But I'm saying this is something that's going to be, whereas you had Polish or you had very ethnic groups that were quite willing to move to Republicans, but African Americans have never moved
to
Republicans.
Well, that's,
I'm wondering if the Hispanics are going to remember.
Well, here's the interesting thing about, and now we're going into kind of a whole strain of thinking and writing about American history that's kind of been going on the last 20 years in which the concept of whiteness has been called into sort of critical relief. And basically, there's a book called How the Irish Became White.
Mm-hmm.
And you've heard of Black Irish. You know, no dogs are Irish allowed.
Right.
And basically, you know, the pattern of American ethnic assimilation is a continual expansion of the groups who are allowed to become sort of unmarked, white, you know, something like the jazz singer, you know. There does seem that kind of impermeable barrier between black and white. You know?
Right.
Yes, anyone can become white, but black people can't become white. Right? You know, but by the same token, in the 1960 election, which is not that long ago, a lot of us, not me, but a lot of you guys probably remember it, African-American voters in the five biggest industrial states, if you read Making the President in 1960, were considered the swing vote. Because there were these vestigial loyalties to the party of Lincoln. And one of the choices the Republican Party made was sending Barry Goldwater to campaign for Richard Nixon in the South. You know, there's a joke about Barry Goldwater. Someday he'll come back to Arizona if we can just get him out of that Confederate War uniform he's wearing. And, you know, like Lyndon Johnson goes to this town, Culpeper, Virginia, which is now where the Library of Congress has its film archive. And says, Lyndon Johnson says, what has Dick Nixon ever done for Culpeper? Which is that no one shoots Santa Claus thing, right? But then by 1964, when the Republicans nominate this cat who voted against the Civil Rights Act, the die is cast. And then, you know, it's still a live issue in 1976 when John Dean is writing an article for Rolling Stone magazine about the Republican convention. He's on the plane with the agricultural secretary and sitting there with him and Pat Boone and Sonny Bono. And said, and I think Pat Boone was one of says, you know, how can Republicans get black voters? It's still this living concern, and the die doesn't seem to have been cast. And the other guy on the plane is the agricultural senator, a secretary, a guy named Earl Butts, and some of you might know his response: all black people want is loose. Black man wanted a loose pair of shoes, something, something, something. And that joke comes out and becomes a liability for the general election. But the point is, the point of the story is, the die was not cast that Democrats would vote 90% for the Republicans until, you know, 1976, 1980. I don't think that we're going to go backwards on that one. But you never know. You know, you really never know. History can turn on a narrow pivot, which is a pretty encouraging thing in dark times like these.
Do you think Reagan was just the right time for Reagan as opposed to being Reagan?
If Reagan had been nominated in 1976, I mean, it really was a Democratic year. I mean, Ford almost pulled it out. That Playboy interview was a very big deal. But you'll have to wait for the next book to read about that.
What do you think is going to happen?
Hey, John.
I mean, are we going to be going... Is the world going... Or America going more conservative, more liberal in the next?
Well, that's up to you.
10 years.
You know, that's up to us. You know, I'm not a fortune teller. You know,
but given the fact, it seems to me you're saying that, you know, when things are perceived as bad, the Republicans win. When things are perceived as good, the Democrats win.
I think that the rule of thumb is that when the elections are framed around economic insecurity, Democrats tend to win. Think of, you know, 2008 and, you know, McCain saying the fundamentals of the economy are sound after this horrible recession. And when the election is framed around issues of cultural anxiety, then the Republicans tend to win. Now, the problem is the Democratic Party has become less and less skilled and adept and eager to frame its elections around these issues of economic populism. And that's a problem. It's a big problem.
We're afraid to say redistribute wealth.
Exactly. Now, if you want, you guys are interested in following that more, tomorrow afternoon I'm doing an interview with the great labor lawyer and cultural critic Tom Gagin at 4 o'clock at the Seminary Co-op, and he has some wonderful answers to these questions. So I'm going to have to defer that question for tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you,
Rick.
Cheers.
Nosrovia.
Yes. Shlanta.